You're listening to in-depth coverage and analysis of the final weeks of the 2020 campaign on the COIN Podcast Network, your local election headquarters.
And it's a choice between the American dream or a totally socialist nightmare. That's what you'll have. You'll be a socialist country. And I said, our country will never be a socialist country. We're not going to let it happen.
Well, all President Trump does is fan the flames of hatred and division. And we should have no tolerance for extremist white supremacist group menacing our community.
We have reached the stretch run in one of the most emotionally charged elections in decades.
The FBI began an investigation earlier this year after becoming aware that a group of individuals was discussing the violent overthrow of certain government and law enforcement components.
Now, as details emerge about a plot to kidnap and kill a duly elected sitting United States governor, there are more signs that the divisiveness is getting dangerous. Today, another chat with noted political scientist Joe Lowndes about extremist groups, why they seem to be increasing in size and support, and the threat they could pose in the final weeks before and the first weeks after the election. I'm Ian Costello. It is Tuesday, October 20th, and you are listening to the COIN Podcast Network coverage of the 2020 election.
My name is Joe Lowndes. I'm a professor of political science at the University of Oregon in Eugene. I've been studying, the right and far right for about 25 years.
Here in the last few weeks, we've learned of this plot to kidnap and, according to reports, kill Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, orchestrated by an extremist group in Michigan and allegedly with material support from some people in some other states. Professor Lowndes, thank you for joining me. If we can start here, how many of these extremist groups do you believe exist in the United States?
Likely hundreds of them, maybe as many as 1,000. It's difficult to say precisely, in part because these days a lot of social movement activity among extremist right-wing groups happens kind of loosely over social media platforms like Facebook or, other platforms that are being generated by far-right organizations themselves. So sometimes you don't need actual organizational structures or cell structures. People put out general calls. For instance, during the fires here last month in Oregon, when there was, a kind of a widespread belief in rural Oregon that Antifa and Black Lives Matter were setting these fires for the purposes of looting and causing chaos and whatever else. And this kind of went out kind of across social media. Conspiracy theories just kind of spread fast and furious by local groups, by, different groups. And so then people kind of spontaneously or voluntaristically set up these, checkpoints, these armed checkpoints, like the one in Malala and other places. So these were not, necessarily tight organizational structures that made these decisions. These were kind of, more broad. I think recently, though, there's been a kind of a merging of this broader loose social media network and organizational structures.
What kind of people claim membership in these groups? And at their core, what do they espouse to believe? Who are these people and what do they want?
These days, there's all kinds of people with all kinds of different beliefs that populate the far right in the United States. And it's very big and it's diffuse. One area, open white nationalists who want to create a white ethnostate, usually in the Pacific Northwest. They're deeply committed to kind of racial utopian visions and are absolutely convinced that any advance of racial equality is white genocide. Those groups kind of made their public debut in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. There was a lot of public rejection of them after Unite the Right, after Heather Heyer was killed by a white supremacist named James Fields. In the subsequent years, a kind of a broader patriot militia movement emerged. These groups kind of develop their membership or identification with them, in the last couple of years, groups like the Oath Keepers, which is made up of current and former military veterans and current and former law enforcement officers. And you have groups like the Three Percenters. which are not so much an organization and more of kind of a people loosely identify with kind of an expansive idea of the Second Amendment and fears of tyrannical government, fears of federal government takeover.
Professor Lowndes, in the more recent reporting on these extremist groups, a lot of news organizations have dropped the use of the term militia and exchanged it with the term domestic terrorists. Is that fair?
You know, I would say if you have organized, heavily armed groups that have designs and plans to carry out violence, kidnappings, and want to create political chaos through violence, then yes, domestic terrorism is really the only proper designation, probably. The problem is that there's no clear line of where domestic terrorism ends and where kind of a much broader social movement begins, right? Like people have people in the neighborhoods who fly a 3%er flag or Oath Keeper supporters, or, you know, have shown up in large numbers at protests. And then, you know, if you think about people like the 17-year-old kid, Kyle Rittenhouse, who murdered two Black Lives Matter activists in late August, he had been called as part of a broad Facebook call by the Kenosha Guard to come out to Kenosha, Wisconsin, and defend local businesses and that kind of thing. Not organized as part of an underground cell. He's just a kid who happened to have access to an AR-15 and could get transportation from his home in Illinois to Kenosha.
Joe, are these groups getting bigger, or because of the recent headlines, are we just paying more attention to them?
One of the things that's happened really is that these militia groups have grown in size and influence, partly because they're not openly white supremacists. They're not neo-Nazis. They kind of just have kind of a broad anti-government, partly libertarian, paranoid, and conspiratorial view of the world. They're often anti-immigrant. And so they can kind of like tap into a larger part of the public, and they can really reach into kind of Trump country, reach into like regular, you know, right-wing Trump voters who have themselves been supporters of Trump, have had a steady diet of far-right ideology from the White House, from Trump himself.
So what do we know about the people who may not necessarily be members of groups like the 3%ers or the Oath Keepers, but who may choose to voice support for them or at least not disavow their behavior?
So these militia groups have branched over into the electorate among Trump supporters who see themselves often as really embattled and fighting for their lives for control against the deep state. One thing also then to know about these groups then is that their potential in the, you know, among the citizenry is can be quite broad. People can decide they want to support these militias and not feel like they're white supremacists or a neo-Nazi or whatever. They can just see themselves as good patriots defending the president, defending core values of American politics.
What is it about our recent history that seems to have shined a bit of a spotlight on these groups?
There are two events that matter here that have kind of really brought these militias to the fore. And the first was the anti-mask or anti-lockdown demonstrations that started last May. And these Michigan was one of the places where these were very strong. Oregon had major demonstrations in Salem, which brought together conspiracy theorists, Proud Boys, 3%ers, Oath Keepers, anti-vaxxers, evangelicals who were afraid that their churches were going to be permanently shut down by the government. And this kind of then extended the reach of far-right kind of militia and conspiratorial groups into the public much more. And then the second thing was demonstrations that followed the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, the largest demonstrations in American history, which reached all over the country, produced a backlash of groups that saw Black Lives Matter and Antifa as wanting to start a next civil war. So militias were able to put out thousands or maybe even tens of thousands of people on the streets across the country in counter protests, either as All Lives Matter protests, Blue Lives Matter protests, pro-Trump and pro-police protests, and often with kind of an elaborate idea of who they think Black Lives Matter is or who they think Antifa is and what they're doing. And so this has actually helped generate a much larger movement, which has moved into a focus on the 2020 election.
As we head into the election and the news of the plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer keeps making headlines, what would you say is driving them? Are these people frightened? Are they emboldened? Is it a little bit of both?
I think these groups are both fearful. Different people are fearful of different things. I think that a lot of white people in these groups are afraid that Black Lives Matter is asserting fundamental rights for African Americans in a way that feels scary for them. I think people who fear immigrants coming to the country, non-white immigrants, fear changes in culture and in kind of like the white racial identity as being the national identity in America. Then you've got a lot of people who are just probably caught up in a lot of the social dislocations and disturbances that have come about because of COVID-19. And they are then more available to conspiracy theories like QAnon, which operate not through rational thought, not through critical thinking, but through emotion. They short circuit rational thinking and get you at an emotional place of fear and paranoia, and then draw you in that way. So for many people, they just feel fearful and look to QAnon as a way of kind of explaining the world to them and explaining their place in it. More organized elements like Ayman Bundy's group, you know, Malheur Wildlife Takeover Public Face, is operating in 16 states with hundreds of local organizers. There's a set of beliefs that they think that they can push onto other people.
Obviously, when Ayman Bundy led the Malheur takeover in the winter of 2016, his group was heavily armed. Bringing our discussion forward to the 2020 election, and seeing that the Michigan Secretary of State has just recently banned open carry firearms at polling places, how concerned are you that we could see violence on Election Day here in the United States?
I think it's likely that we're going to see at least sporadic Election Day violence. One thing to remember is that the fight for voting rights, for the basic franchise, has been met with violence repeatedly throughout American history. The most recent we can think of is, you know, the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, where, you know, there was intimidation, violence, and murder. But, you know, even after that, people like former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, William Rehnquist, cut his teeth as a Republican activist showing up in Arizona polling stations to kind of intimidate Latino voters, not armed, but showing up in force to challenge their credentials and that kind of thing. So, you know, this kind of thing is not entirely foreign. And then there's another kind of immediate history here, which we should think about, which is the 2000 election. This is when George W. Bush ran against Al Gore. There was a lot of messiness in terms of the count and in terms of the role of absentee ballots, which made it a contested election in Florida and New Mexico and some other states. And one of the things that happened is that the Republican Party organized what people afterwards called Brooks Brothers riots. They sent Republican voters and Republican Party members to show up where votes were being counted in Dade and Seminole County in Florida, for instance. And they demonstrated and they shouted and they yelled and they made trouble and kind of produced a kind of chaos, made it very difficult for people to do vote counts of absentee ballots, and also helped create the conditions that allowed the Supreme Court to step in and decide the election for George W. Bush. Now, it was unprecedented that the Supreme Court would step in that way in a presidential election, and the Supreme Court has suffered, I think, since then in terms of questions of legitimacy, given that it looked like a powerfully partisan move.
That 5-4 Supreme Court decision in favor of George W. Bush in 2000 didn't come until 5 weeks after the election. As we are wrapping up here, Professor Lowndes, and thank you again for spending some time with me today, with as divisive and charged as this race is, what can you see playing out in the 5 weeks or so after the 2020 election?
You can think about a much more amplified version of the Brooks Brothers riots happening now, with a much more armed populace and with a president who's been saying for months and months that any election outcome besides him winning will be illegitimate. 35% of the country strongly supporting Trump and being told over and over by their president that if he doesn't win, it will have been the result of illegitimacy. And then there are going to be court challenges continually across the country, likely to mail-in ballots and absentee ballots by the Trump administration. And then you may have actually federal agents showing up at polling precincts to stop vote counting if it looks like Trump has won as a result of people who voted, you know, in person as opposed to people who voted by mail. And then if you have court challenges, then you have the possibility of all kinds of chaos and demonstrations and counter demonstrations. And you can imagine the far right attacking supporters of Biden out in the streets. And so the possibilities of things getting really hairy in the days and weeks after the election are quite apparent, I think.
Professor Lowndes, thank you very much. Also today, more reports here in the Pacific Northwest and from across the country that early voting numbers are far outpacing those from 2016 and in several states, breaking all-time records. Next week, we will check in on the most recent numbers and take a deep dive into what a massive increase in voter turnout could mean for election results.
Thank you for listening to the Coin Podcast Network. You can listen to more great Coin podcasts on coin.com/podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Please listen, download, subscribe, and review.
Hey, everybody. Executive producer Ian Costello here, coming to you from the Work From Home Coin Podcast Studios. When we started our podcasts back in February of 2019, we had no idea that we would end up here. Now, a year and a half later, tens of thousands of you are listening to hundreds of our podcasts, and we need to make some changes to grow even further. That's why, starting this week, you can find all of the Coin podcasts in one place. The brand new Coin Podcast Network. From Beaver Smack to Writer's Block. From your weather to our constant coverage of the coronavirus pandemic and the protests in Portland. It is all available in one place. So, to keep hearing the podcasts you already love and to discover more of our exclusive audio content, head to coin.com/podcasts or search Coin, that's K-O-I-N, on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, or Podbean. Thank you for listening.